About 3 years ago, David Squire, our church administrator, came to me and said, "You know, Jeff, you ought to take your sermon series on homosexuality in the Bible and reduce it to written form." Now, you have to understand how our church works. Nominally, I am the boss, but David is really in charge. Have you ever seen Mimi on the Drew Carey Show? Well, I kind of think of David like that. Not so much in appearance, but in personality, you see. And so when David... By the way, take that off there, please. Try to get that image out of your mind, huh? So when David Squire said to me, "You ought to reduce this to writing," I said, "Yes, sir, I'll get right to it, sir, as fast as I can, sir," but I didn't know where I would ever find the time to do it. Then it occurred to me, God always gives the gifts that we need, that Tyler Conley is a member of our church, a wonderful writer. He was working on his master's in biblical studies at Earlham School of Religion. And so I went to Tyler and I said, "Will you help me with this project?" He agreed. And so he and I got to work under the watchful eye of David Squire. And as we progressed, we quickly concluded that we needed to expand the scope beyond a simple written summary to a full-scale book, because we weren't finding out there any works that were comprehensive in treating the subject of homosexuality in the Bible that had been written in the last 10 years outside of academia. No books for a broad and wide audience. And so we decided that we needed to step back and take the approach that the Dalai Lama took when he walked up to the hot dog vendor. Do you know what the Dalai Lama said to the hot dog vendor? "Make me one with everything." You don't get it, do you? Make me a hot dog with everything. Make me one with the universe. You get it? Make me one with... We decided we wanted one with everything, a book that would comprehensively address all of the scriptures relevant to homosexuality in the Bible. That's why it took us 3 years. We set to work. We tried to get it right. We're trying to be very, very accurate and to document all of this in a way that is reputable. And now, finally, God be praised, after 3 years, the book is ready. And this book does not belong to me or to Tyler. It belongs to our church. The church holds the copyright. And all proceeds from the book will go into our building fund for continuing development of our property here. This is our joint asset, our ministry tool at the congregation. Today, I want to give you a little bit of a foreshadowing of what you'll find in here. But even more importantly, I want to remind us why it is so very important that we be sharing this information. Let's pray. Spirit of God, make this church and make each one of us individually beacons of light and hope for a people who have been spiritually trampled. Energize us, equip us to share the good news. In Jesus' name, amen. My final year of law school, I lived in the home of a 90-year-old woman whose deceased husband had been a professor at Harvard Law School. She lived in a grand old house in classic Cambridge style. I was her student, and so I stayed in the student room up on the third floor. But of a morning, I got to come downstairs to the dining room and share breakfast with her. Sitting along that long formal table, she would perch at the end of the table on a little pillow because she was just a short woman. And as we sat there and shared breakfast, frequently Miss Wilson would say something like, "I had the most vivid dream last night." She would always say it that way. "I had the most vivid dream last night." And I would say, "Well, tell me about your dream." Once she told me how she had been making her bed. She heard a rustling behind her. "I turned around," she said, "and there was Joe," her deceased husband, "just as real as life, and everything was like it used to be until I awakened." And then she sat back and smiled wistfully. Ah, how sad, you might think, to be an old woman living on dreams of yesterday. But you know, I never found it sad, because Miss Wilson had lived a long and wonderful life, and now, in her twilight years, she was getting to relive some of those most beautiful memories. Do you want to know what is sad? I'll tell you what is sad. A person who has never lived his or her dreams. Randy was about 15 years old. He lived on a big old farm somewhere out in the vast middle of America. Randy was a devout Christian. God and church were at the center of his existence. But Randy also had a secret. He wanted a boyfriend. But he knew what his pastor had said about people like that. They're perverts. They're an abomination in the eyes of God. And Randy didn't want to offend God or his parents or his church. And so he began to pray, "Dear God, please change me." For months he prayed that prayer, but nothing changed. His frustration grew. His fear grew. Until finally one day when he got out of bed, he knew what he needed to do. He called his dog. He picked up his father's shotgun. They went together out into a huge field far beyond where anyone could see, and there he knelt and began to pray, "Dear God, I am sorry for what I'm about to do, but please understand, it's the only way I can stop sinning." As tears streamed down his face, he reached out and gave his old dog a few last pets, and then picked up the shotgun, aimed it at himself, and pulled the trigger. The dog yelped. The boy slumped over dead. It was 12 hours before the search party found him lying there, his old dog still keeping solemn vigil. What could have caused it? It must have been a hunting accident. And just as sure as you sit there in your chair, you know that this is the story of our people, time and time again, with slight variation, thousands, maybe even millions of our people over the ages. How many of our young men have simply disappeared? How many of our young women have been driving along in their parents' car, and suddenly, for no apparent reason, the car just veered off the road and into a telephone pole, and all the people of the town say it was such a shame. She had so much to live for. Barbara Wells was a member of our congregation before moving to Florida. She once told me about how when she was 14 years old, she attended an Adventist school, a Christian school in Dayton, Ohio. There she met a 16-year-old girl named Leanne. They became wonderful friends. Now, Leanne was different. She was adopted, for starters, but she was what they called in that day and age retarded. But that didn't matter to Barb. Somehow they just clicked. They would walk around the school hand in hand. Frequently, they would give each other hugs. Everything they did together. Until some concerned women of the church came to Barb's mom. Barb's mom said to her, "You will have no further contact with Leanne." Barb refused, and so Barb's mom called a meeting with the principal. They dragged in Leanne and Leanne's mother and some of the concerned women of the church. They set Barb outside the principal's office, but she could hear the shouting inside, the brutal accusation. Leanne was perverting the girls of this school. After all, if someone was perverting them, it must be the one who is different that is doing it. Unsatisfied with the results of that meeting, Barb's mom decided drastic measures were called for. She sent Barb 500 miles away to another Adventist school, where Barb proceeded to fall in love with Nancy. They went away to college together. Their relationship was beautiful. But Nancy kept feeling so guilty, so she broke it off. Barb was crushed. She called her mom and poured out her soul. Alarmed, her mother raced to the school and placed Barb involuntarily in the Harding Sanitarium, an Adventist psychiatric hospital, so that her daughter could be fixed by psychotherapy and Christian prayer. There, Barb was warehoused for a number of months until she was released back to the school on the condition that she see a Christian therapist once a week. By now, Barb said, I was so beaten down, I was ready to become whatever they wanted me to be, so I dropped out of school and I decided to marry a man. But as long as I had to marry a man, Barb said, I figured I may as well marry one who would be away much of the time, and so she married a trucker. But even that didn't work out the way she'd expected, because he was home often enough to regularly beat her. Barb says, I began drinking like a fish. And above all else, she said, I hated God. Stop! Jeff, I don't want to hear any more of these stories. You're reminding me of my past, and I'm beyond that now, and I just want to forget the pain and move on. But we have to hear these stories. We have to remember. We need to hear these stories until we are sick in the pit of our stomachs and say, I am going to be part of the solution, because you know that the vast majority of our people are still back there on the other side of the Red Sea in Egypt. The vast majority of humanity who is like us, they are still living in suffering and pain, waiting for a solution. Ken Rushton grew up here in Indianapolis in the late 60s, the early 70s. He attended Baptist Temple, you know, the huge church on the south side of town that recently had all those tax problems. Ken loved God and church. He went to their Christian school there. In fact, in 1973, he graduated valedictorian. After he graduated, he went to work in the church office. His best friend was the pastor's son, Greg Dixon Jr. Life was good, but he was different. So Ken started making contact with the gay community. There he met and made a boyfriend. They became partners. His partner was Joe Miller. And everything was wonderful until word leaked back to the Baptist Temple. When they found out he was summarily fired, there was no discussion. There was no offer of prayer. There was no expression of concern. His best friend, Greg Dixon Jr., said nothing to him, not one word after that day. He was simply cut off. Feeling that he was living under condemnation, he would often pray. His partner says, I would see him praying at night fervently, earnestly, God, please change me. But of course, he wasn't changed until over time he drifted away from his faith. He moved away from Indianapolis. He developed a drug habit, and a few years ago, reaching the end of his rope, finally, Ken Rushton took his life. So many broken dreams among our people. I had a dream that I could have shared with Miss Wilson. Miss Wilson, do you want to hear my dream? My dream is that someday I'll meet a nice young man and we can settle down together and raise some puppies and kitties. And we can serve God together, and we will walk hand in hand in golden fields at sunset. But Miss Wilson, do you know what I was doing last night while all my friends and classmates were dreaming their dreams and looking forward to a bright future? I was flipping through the phone book looking for Dr. Nikolai's number. Do you know who Dr. Nikolai is, Miss Wilson? He's that psychiatrist over at Harvard Medical School that has the reputation of being a Christian. And so like some stalker, desperate and afraid, I flipped through until I found his number and called him out of the blue and said, Doctor, can you help me? Doctor, please tell me you can fix me. Because you see, back then I thought that because I was different, I was sick. And I'll bet many of you have been at the same place at one point or another. And who can blame us? Because it's what we've been taught. It's all we have been taught, and we have drunk deeply of that well. Last Sunday night, before going to bed, I had some milk and cookies. That's my habit, and I am a creature of habit. So I had my milk and cookies, and after that, being a creature of habit, I have a routine. I go and fill a glass of water with, a glass with water, set it on the counter, go upstairs, brush my teeth, come back downstairs, drink the water to wash the toothpaste taste out of my mouth. Well, as I went through this routine, I had forgotten that the day before, my spouse David, not Mimi David, but my spouse David, too many Davids in this church, my spouse David had filled a glass of water himself, set it down on the counter when one of our little cats, Pinky Stinky, jumped up on the counter, made her way over to this glass, and just started drinking out of it like it was hers. Now, Pinky's wish is David's command. So David thought, if she wants a glass of water, she should have a glass of water and get to drink like a human. So he left it there for her. She became obsessed with this glass. Over the next 24 hours, we saw her repeatedly returning and lapping water out of this glass. So we left it there. I had forgotten this as I went through my routine, went up, brushed my teeth, came back downstairs, grabbed that big glass of water that was sitting there on the counter, and started drinking. I was about halfway through the glass of water when I remember thinking, this doesn't taste quite right. And then it hit me, cat water! I spewed it out of my mouth! It almost made me sick to my stomach! Even more embarrassing, about a half hour later, David found me sitting on the newspaper, hauling it like this. They say you are what you eat, you are what you drink. And many of us have had a similar experience. We have drunk so frequently and so deeply of that cat water, or in this case, that wicked spiritual brew of condemnation, that it has become a part of us. And we start thinking like those who condemn us, that because I am different, I must be sick. This is not a new way of thinking. In fact, people of faith throughout the centuries have been enamored with this way of thinking. There's even a term for it. It's often called, if you'll give me the first slide there, James, it's often called creation order theology. The idea that at creation, God established certain classes of life. Life forms that were destined to live within fixed boundaries that are not to be crossed, lest creation be thrown into confusion. An excellent example is found in the Old Testament, the book of Leviticus, the 11th chapter, which gives us a list of animals that are designated as unclean for food. The idea is that if you were to eat these animals, who were, in God's eyes, an abomination, you too would be committing an abomination. So you were not to eat them. The list in Leviticus 11 includes things like the rock badger, the stork, the bat, the pig, so on and so forth. There is a growing scholarly consensus that these animals ended up on the list of unclean foods because in some way they departed from what was considered normative for their class. For example, as I talked to the children about in the children's sermon, bats, they're quadrupeds. They have four legs. We all know that four-legged animals are supposed to get around on their four legs, but bats fly. It is a confusion of the distinction between quadrupeds and birds. Therefore, bats were an abomination. A stork. Everyone knows a stork is a bird that's meant to fly. Certainly not to swim or to dive. But storks are waterfowl. They wade into the water. They dive their beak beneath the water and capture their prey. This was a confusion, a crossing of the boundaries that were set forth at creation according to this way of thinking. Therefore, storks were an abomination. You see, this is a way of thinking that is very boundary-oriented. These people are looking for bright, clear lines, kind of like a judge sitting in the courtroom looking for bright, clear lines. By the way, did you hear what the judge said when a skunk came into his courtroom? Odor in the court, odor in the court. Are you with me or against me here, all right? Order in the court! That's this way of thinking. If something is surprising, out of the ordinary, like a skunk in the courtroom, it's got to be banished. It cannot be, because the world needs to be neat and orderly. David Squire, Mimi David, has a little cartoon hanging in the office upstairs that shows two bulls who are leaning on a fence talking to one another. One bull has his nose ring in, as is typical for bulls, but the other bull has taken his nose ring out of his nose and put it in his ear. The caption beneath it has the normal bull saying to the adventurous bull, "You'd better get it back in your nose. Here comes your dad." That's creation order thinking. Are you not getting my jokes tonight, or is it just me? It must be you. It can't be me. That is creation order thinking. The type of thinking that says, if God wanted you to have purple hair, Scott, He would have given you purple hair. See what you have started, Dooley? These rules about unclean foods, they may have served a legitimate purpose when they were first articulated as Israel came together as a nation, because Israel was in the midst of a bunch of very different nations, and so a unique diet may well have helped Israel establish a unique culture that helped her separate from the surrounding pagan nations and some of their pagan practices. So these rules may well have served a legitimate purpose when they were first articulated, but you see, over time, through the generations, they were handed down and down, long after they had outlived their usefulness, until they became and influenced a whole way of thinking. And therefore, it should come as no surprise that we see this way of thinking spilling over into other areas and even influencing how people were viewed. For example, the book of Leviticus also says that people, human beings, who are lame or who are blind are unclean and banished from the temple. Because everybody knows that God created human beings to walk and to see. And so a human being who is departing from that norm, there must be evil somewhere in that equation. And I'll bet you see where this is going. This is the very same logic, the path of thinking that causes so many of our Christian sisters and brothers to condemn us. Because they say, look, God created males to mate with females and vice versa. And so when a woman settles down with a woman, it is a confusion of creation order. It cannot be. It is an abomination. And we have learned that way of thinking, not just overtly, but in a million subtle ways, because this way of thinking permeates much of American Christianity, much of Christianity in other countries too. It has come to permeate our way of thinking about God, and it becomes instinctive for us. I got an email a couple weeks ago from a gay youth, college age, living somewhere out in eastern Indiana, still living with his parents, and they're using the leverage of paying for his college to keep him there, and to force him to read Joe Dallas's book. Joe Dallas is the head of Exodus International, and his book, one of his books, is called Desires and Conflict. The premise of the book is that homosexuality is a sickness caused by bad parenting. And so, and other bad things that happen in life. And so, this young man sends me an email and says, what's really scaring me about this book is that as I read it, what he says makes sense to me. I sent him back an email and said, of course it makes sense to you. It's all you've ever heard. You have been weaned on creation order theology. And so many of us carry around this heavy burden, saying, I know it's wrong, but what am I going to do about it? Sisters and brothers, I have good news. In fact, it's not my good news, it's Jesus' good news. The good news is that Jesus Christ, in our first gospel reading, Mark chapter 7, pointedly, intentionally, and sweepingly tossed out creation order theology. In Mark chapter 7 and verse 23, Jesus has just finished a theological argument with the Pharisees, fed up to hear with their legalistic, false ordered way of thinking. Jesus is ready to make a radical and sweeping pronouncement, to go out on a limb, so to speak. And so He summons the crowd to come to Him. Now, ordinarily, the crowd sought out Jesus. It's unusual for Jesus to seek out a crowd. But apparently, what He was going to say was so important, He could not wait. And so Jesus summons the crowd to Him, and in verse 23, He says to them, as the crowd settled down, listen to me and understand. There is nothing that goes into a person that can defile him or her. Because what goes in through the mouth passes through the stomach and out into the sewer. But, Jesus says, what defiles a person is what comes out of the heart. Wickedness, hatred, violence, greed. These, Jesus said, are the things that defile. And with this, the author of the Gospel of Mark says in verse 19, with this quote, Jesus declared all foods clean. All animals, Jesus said, are clean for food, sweeping aside this way of thinking. And to establish his point, as he embraces the diversity in God's creation, to establish his point, Jesus appeals to simple common sense, the notion that externalities do not matter. In effect, what Jesus is saying is that the physical anatomy of the animals you may eat are irrelevant to your soul because it just passes through the stomach. It doesn't affect your spiritual nature. Externalities don't matter. When I was in college, I did not have nearly so keen a sense of fashion as I do now. So sometimes I would wear things that didn't always work together. For example, and remember this was the 70s, all right? For example, one of my favorite ensembles was a pair of maroon plaid, I guess you would call them hip huggers, the kind of pants you're not supposed to wear with a belt, you know? And I would wear that with a white shirt that had a bunch of little blue flowers on it, little daisies. And I thought I was styling. I remember one morning wearing this as I walked across campus to breakfast. And there was a gal walking down the sidewalk in the opposite direction, and she really gave me the eye. I mean, she did one of these. And I remember thinking to myself, and I'm not lying, I remember thinking to myself, man, I really look good today. Now, let me ask you, did the fact that I had no fashion sense, that I was wearing strange, weird, different clothes, did that affect my soul? No. And externality, we know that what people wear, it doesn't make them a bad person. Externalities don't matter. This is the simple logic Jesus is presenting. The physical, whether the animal you're eating has four legs and wings, or just two legs and wings, or four legs and no wings, it doesn't matter. And by extension of that same logic, the physical anatomy of the person you choose to love does not affect the soul either. You women may end up falling in love with some cute little bat girl with beady eyes and pointed ears. Celebrate that. It is a gift of God. You men may fall in love with some lanky stork of a man with long legs and a beak nose. Celebrate that. Don't fear it. The physical anatomy of the people you love, the genital construction of the people you love, is no more relevant than how many legs a bat has. What matters is how you treat that person, what is coming out of the heart. Jesus declared all foods clean, and in the process he swept away and utterly rejected this way of thinking that people are still trying to use against us because they haven't gotten it. Let's help them get it. But I know what some of you are thinking. I know that Denise is sitting there thinking, will this sermon ever end? And I know that Julie's over there thinking, old MacDonald had a fine deal. But the rest of you are probably sitting there thinking, you know, what Jesus says, I see the logic there, and I see how it applies to us. That makes sense. But I really wish that Jesus had said something that specifically addresses us so that we could be absolutely sure. That is why we read the second gospel passage, Matthew 19. It's a passage that talks about eunuchs. Who were these people called eunuchs? James, if you'll give me the next slide. Eunuchs were a class of servants in the ancient world responsible for supervising and guarding the living quarters of women, of the women of the palace or women of wealthy households. Now, one of the deep concerns that the ancient masters, of the household had, whether they were the king or simply a wealthy man, one of the concerns you would have with eunuchs, and the position of eunuch was always filled by males, was that one of your eunuchs would have an affair with one of the women in your harem, or worse yet, rape one of the women in your harem, thereby impregnating them and clouding, confusing the lines of inheritance. And the lines of inheritance were very important in ancient times. So if you were the master of a household looking to hire someone to be a eunuch and watch after your women in close proximity with them, who would be the perfect candidate? Some man who had the reputation for being interested in men instead of women, right? This position was tailor-made for male homosexuals. Not to mention the fact that what self-respecting male homosexual would not give his right arm in order to live among the king's harem and be able to consult with these women on their clothes and their hair fashions for a career? I mean, this position was perfect, right? A magnet for homosexual males. And guess what? In the ancient literature of the time, that is what we see. Abundant evidence that there was a stereotype that associated eunuchs with what we today call male homosexuality. For example, in the Old Testament, an Old Testament book in the Catholic Bible, the book of Sirach, chapter 30 and verse 20, says that when a eunuch embraces a woman, he groans. I think it was the Roman poet Lucian who said, some of you guys understand this, don't you? The ancient Roman poet Lucian, I believe it was, who said that a eunuch has as much need for a woman as a bald man for a comb. The Kama Sutra, which was an Indian sacred text in the ancient world, has a whole chapter talking about how eunuchs supposedly seduced other men. Getting the picture? Now, those are just three sites. Many more are cited in the book. But as you survey the ancient literature, you see again and again references to a stereotype that assumed that eunuchs were disinterested in women and affirmatively interested in men. Now, I'm not saying that every eunuch was a homosexual, just that so many of them were that in the popular mind, the two became associated. Introducing yourself as a eunuch in the ancient world would be akin to today introducing yourself as a hairdresser from San Francisco. You may not be, but there's a lot of suspicion. This is the relationship between the two categories. Now, some eunuchs were castrated. Some masters, out of an abundance of caution, would castrate their eunuchs to be sure that there would be no impregnation. But we know from ancient literature that many eunuchs were not castrated. They were referred to as natural or born eunuchs, eunuchs who consistently showed a disinterest in women and interest in men. We find a very interesting discussion of natural born eunuchs in the ancient Jewish Talmud. The Talmud was compiled in written form several hundred years after the time of Christ, but is based on oral traditions that go back to and beyond the time of Christ. So the Talmud gives us an excellent snapshot of cultural thinking in and around the time of Jesus Christ. In the Jewish Talmud, Rabbi Eliezer speaks about natural eunuchs and allows as how he thinks they can be cured. Does that sound familiar? There's another place where the Talmud talks about the warning signs that you may be dealing with a natural-born eunuch. After all, you don't want to be surprised by things like this. And so there's a warning list there. James, if you'll give me the next slide, here are some of the things they say to watch out for. A man with soft hair, a sparse beard, a high-pitched voice, smoothness of skin, urine that does not arc, or a body that does not steam when bathing in winter. you recognize what this is? This is the ancient equivalent of the modern stereotype that effeminacy equals homosexuality. Except back then, I guess they thought if you were a manly man, you would pee with enough force to create an arc. If you were a manly man back then, when you took a bath in the winter, your body would steam because manly men generate lots of heat, you know. Here's the stereotype. So that you would know if you were dealing, and it was important to know if you were dealing with a eunuch, because you see, eunuchs were deemed unclean. Eunuchs were banned from the presence of the Jewish temple. But remember, Jesus swept away, in Mark 7, the basis for that kind of thinking. And then he closes the circle in our second reading in Matthew chapter 19, where he talks about eunuchs. Now, the context of the passage in Matthew 19 is that the Pharisees have asked Jesus a question about divorce. And Jesus responds by saying Moses allowed divorce as a concession to human weakness. But, Jesus says, that's not God's ideal. God's ideal, Jesus says, is one man, one woman, in marriage together forever. Aha! Some of our Christian brothers and sisters will say, there it is! Creation order thinking, right in the words of Jesus. But, you have to read the rest of the passage. Because after Jesus says that, his disciples say to him, you know, if that's the way it is, if divorce is permissible only under narrow circumstances and is not consistent with God's will, then maybe the disciples say it is better for a man not to marry. And Jesus responds to that beginning in verse 10 by saying, not everyone can receive this, but only those to whom it is given. And then Jesus lists three categories of men who are not meant in God's order of things to marry women. Let's look at that verse, verse 12, Matthew 19, verse 12. Jesus says, there are eunuchs who have been so from birth. And there are eunuchs who have been made eunuchs by others. And there are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. Let anyone accept this who can. Let anyone accept this who can. Let's go in reverse order. Jesus mentions at the end of this verse, eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. What would be a modern example of someone who fits this category? A Catholic priest. Or a Catholic nun, if you flip the gender. What is the most prominent biblical example of someone who lived in this third category? Paul. The most prominent, though, would be Jesus. It is fascinating to me that when looking for words to describe the class to which he belonged, Jesus chose a term that he knew full well had all of these connotations with homosexuality that we've just talked about. Now, I'm not saying that Jesus was trying to wink at us and hint that he was homosexual. What I'm saying is that there is an abundant absence in the words of Jesus of any homophobia. Can you imagine Jerry Falwell describing himself with a word that has connotations of homosexuality? Can you imagine Jerry Falwell saying to his TV church audience, yesterday I felt kind of queer? No, he would never talk that way because he knows that when you say queer, even though it's a normal English word, that it has all those connotations. And yet here is Jesus using a word with all those connotations to describe the category that he's from. But that's not all. He goes on. The middle category here are eunuchs who have been made so by others. These would be the castrated, those who have been castrated. But look at the first category. Jesus says, there are eunuchs who have been so from birth. That would be us. It's the same terminology, born eunuchs, that we see in the Jewish Talmud. But gone is the necessity for a cure. Gone are the warning signs, lest you bump into one of these people unwittingly. And instead, Jesus lists us right alongside other honored class. In fact, the class to which he himself belonged. Not only that, but he says, we were born that way, that we were created. Next time one of your fundamentalist friends says, this is a choice you've made, It's not the way God made you. Turn them to Matthew 19:12. Explain to them the history of who eunuchs were at that time. And then read them Jesus' words, which affirm that God had made us that way. And we know that all that God made is good. Then we have closed the circle. Here is Jesus' understanding of creation order. He says the predominant paradigm is one man, one woman in marriage. And we can celebrate with Jesus that that is God's will for the vast majority of humanity. But he's careful to point out that there are a minority of us who are meant by God to follow a different path that is also honored and beautiful in the eyes of God. This is good news that we ought to be shouting from every mountain top. I had another dream the other night. In this dream, I was in a radiant town. And I saw this resplendent, brilliant being that looked like this. A resplendent fairy that bore a remarkable resemblance to Michael Driscoll. Actually, I think I'm confusing this with a nightmare I had. Take that off there, please. If you didn't hear Mike's sermon, what was it, 12 months ago, he had all these pictures of me and all sorts of get-up, so I had to get even with Mike. Back to my dream, the real dream. In my dream, it was the millennial reign of Christ. The world as we know it had been swept away, and Jesus had established peace on earth, a golden age destined to last 1,000 years. And as I walked down the streets in this resplendent city, where creation had been restored to the way it was meant to be, I saw off in a distance, Randy. You know the one who shot himself? And he was walking hand in hand with a young man. And they were laughing. And his dog was following. And Jesus smiled. Because finally, under the reign of Christ, the world was working the way it was meant to. When God created us, and before we fell and started dividing and carving up people into all sorts of categories and boxes and saying some are bad and some are good. And then I saw Barb Wells. She was hugging someone I think she called Leanne. And Jesus smiled. And there was Ken Rushton. There was an old man sitting next to him weeping who looked a lot like Greg Dixon Sr. And he kept saying, "I'm so sorry." And Ken said, "That's okay. I forgive you." And Jesus smiled. The Bible says the day will come when God will wipe away all tears, when they who have mourned will be comforted. And we hope and hang on to the cherished hope that the day will come when all of our people of the past who have suffered so mightily, who have had dreams deferred or dreams dashed, who have lived lives that haven't been what God in the ideal wished for them. The day will come when things will be made right, when they will smile, when they will laugh, when they will achieve God's dream for them. It takes the resurrection power of Jesus for something like that to happen. We can't change the past. But with the power of Christ within us, we can change the future. And so let's take these words of Christ and shout them out. Spew out that cat water and drink in the words of Jesus, words of life that can transform us. And then once we are transformed, we can go out of this place and transform the world. That's what this book is about. That's what this church is about. And that is what each one of us is called to do. In the name of Jesus.